refried beans, lentils, and lime peel. Various soy-based foods can also contain large amounts of oxalate. High-purine foods, such as sardines and herring roes, also substantially increase oxalate excretion. Oxalate poisoning has been reported in the literature secondary to an excessive intake of rhubarb. Clearly, a detailed dietary history is critical in the proper management of any patient with kidney stone risk or disease, and merely lessening or discontinuing vitamin C intake as the only significant intervention is not in the patient's best interests. Eliminating one or several of the patient's favorite oxalate-containing foods should always take precedence over lessening or eliminating any regular supplementation of vitamin C. Calcium also plays several roles in the propensity for calcium oxalate stone formation. Reducing the dietary, not supplemental intake of calcium, increases the intestinal absorption of oxalate. Conversely, in a study on 45,619 men, Kerhan et al. Found that a high dietary intake of calcium decreased the risk of symptomatic kidney stones. In looking at 91,731 women, Kerhan et al. Again found that the high dietary intake of calcium decreased the risk of symptomatic kidney stones, whereas intake of supplemental calcium may increase risk. It was also found that vitamin D supplementation increased the excretion of oxalate in humans. Some researchers have actually demonstrated that vitamin C probably lessens the likelihood of kidney stone formation in those individuals who already have a history of stone formation, indicating a possible therapeutic role for vitamin C in the treatment of kidney stone disease. Schwiller et al. Found that vitamin C actually inhibited the development of calcium oxalate crystals in these individuals. Not surprisingly, they also concluded that vitamin C does not play a role in helping the formation of kidney stones under normal conditions. Grasses et al. Were able to demonstrate that free radical damaged cells in an experimental model using living epithelial cells tended to produce a favorable environment for the development of calcium oxalate crystals. They found the vitamin C exerted the most remarkable effects in preventing the formation of calcium oxalate crystals. Selvam found that antioxidant therapy prevented calcium oxalate precipitation in the rat kidney and reduced oxalate excretion in stone patients. Goetz et al. Showed that another antioxidant, lipoic acid, helped prevent the precipitation of calcium oxalate crystals in dogs. Jayanti et al. Also showed that lipoic acid was effective in lowering oxalate levels in the kidneys and urine of rats. As a powerful antioxidant, vitamin C may well have the same effects as lipoic acid. Certainly, vitamin C also quenches free radicals, prevents oxidant-induced damage, and facilitates tissue healing after such damage has been inflicted. Perhaps eliminating focal areas of such tissue damage makes it that much more difficult to initiate an abnormal deposit of calcium oxalate. This may be one significant way in which vitamin C can reduce kidney stone formation. McCormick long ago asserted that his research on vitamin C indicated that a vitamin C deficiency was the basic etiological factor for stone formation anywhere in the body. A typical research report relating vitamin C and kidney stone formation. There have been isolated reports associating vitamin C administration with the formation of kidney stones and/or the worsening of kidney function. Lawton et al. Reported on the case of a 58-year-old woman who developed acute kidney failure from calcium oxalate crystals depositing in the kidneys after the administration of 45,000 milligrams of vitamin C as ascorbic acid intravenously. However, this woman had pre-existing kidney disease, nephrotic syndrome, and a disease called amyloidosis, which was spilling large amounts of proteins, immunoglobulins, in the urine. Amyloidosis often causes nephrotic syndrome, and that was probably the situation with this lady. Prior to the vitamin C administration, the patient was on a regimen that included doses of prednisone, steroid, melphalan and busulfan, cancer chemotherapy drugs, furosemide, diuretic, vitamin B complex, vitamin E, sodium selenite, trazodone hydrochloride, antidepressant, doxycycline, antibiotic, levothyroxine, thyroid hormone, and docusate sodium, stool softener. This patient's urine was already concentrated with abnormal proteins, and the diuretic therapy likely depleted the body's fluids and concentrated the urine even more. The more urine is concentrated with any solutes, such as the abnormal proteins, the more likely any other dissolved substances, such as calcium oxalate, will precipitate out of the solution. Congestive heart failure, an additional diagnosis suggested to be present by the authors, can also decrease the amount and rate of fluid flow in the kidney, contributing to the development of crystal formation and subsequent kidney failure. Furthermore, vitamin B12 can sometimes have toxic effects on certain individuals who take it in supplemental form rather than ingest it in dietary form. The thyroid supplement implies the lady was hypothyroid, which predisposes to even more unforeseen problems. Also, there is no evidence as to what other medicines, vitamins, and/or nutrients were added to the IV bottle along with the vitamin C. Many adult women, especially the elderly, take regular doses of calcium supplements that are often in a rock-like form, like dolomite. Excess calcium looking for a way to fall out of solution in the urine finds a ready partner with the oxalate already concentrated there. If this patient had occasion to take a significant amount of aspirin, this is yet another factor that has been shown to substantially increase urinary oxalate. The only thing that can be stated with certainty is that vitamin C was one of many possible contributing factors to this unfortunate patient's kidney failure. Singh et al. Were able to demonstrate in guinea pigs that vitamin C alone did not cause the formation of kidney and bladder stones. However, they did show that vitamin C given in combination with calcium carbonate and an additional source of oxalate, sodium oxalate, did contribute to stone formation. This also strongly suggests that many patients who develop kidney stones after supplementing vitamin C are taking calcium ascorbate rather than sodium ascorbate or ascorbic acid, calcium supplements, or both. Cathcart, in his experience with thousands of patients, routinely gave vitamin C infusions as sodium ascorbate in lactated Ringer's solution and nothing else, except for tiny amounts of EDTA to prevent oxidation of the vitamin C. As a result, he never reported any catastrophic events or even any significant minor side effects. Whenever a multitude of other vitamins, minerals, and nutrients are added to a vitamin C infusion, negative outcomes cannot be reliably blamed on only the vitamin C. Furthermore, Lawton et al. Even acknowledged that the wrong pH in a vitamin C infusion was capable of causing a significant conversion of the vitamin C into oxalate before it was ever given to the patient. While the vitamin C infusion was likely a contributing factor to the unfortunate clinical outcome in the patient of Lawton et al., it would appear that multiple other factors played strong contributory roles in the precipitation of calcium oxalate crystals in the kidneys. Pre-existing kidney disease should always invoke extra care in the administration of supplemental vitamin C, and additional factors such as possible dehydration secondary to chronic diuretic therapy and soft-flowing, thick urine already concentrated with abnormal amounts of protein merit close attention. Caution and close monitoring should always be part of any additional therapies that impose more of a solute, dissolved substance load to sick and compromised kidneys already being taxed with an abnormally high solute load. Also, as long as water retention with a disease such as congestive heart failure is not present, Vigorous hydration should always accompany vitamin supplementation. A number of other papers and case reports have attempted to connect vitamin C and increased calcium oxalate deposition with various degrees of kidney failure. However, no report could be found in which an extensive analysis of the other potential sources of oxalate and calcium was made. Only rarely were any of the stone-promoting items previously listed even mentioned as being specifically present or absent. Every report appeared content to place all or most of the blame upon intravenous or oral vitamin C for the oxalate-related consequences. Some of these reports include the following, in which the presence of only a few of many other stone risk factors is noted. 1. Schwartz et al. Reported on a 22-year-old woman who developed compromised kidney function after receiving home parenteral nutrition with intravenous vitamin C following resection of nearly the entire small intestine. Both the parenteral nutrition and the small intestine resection can produce increased oxalate, along with the vitamin C. Such patients also tend to be dehydrated. 2. Mashour et al. Reported on a 31-year-old man who developed acute renal failure after a 6-day history of headache and a 3-day history of nausea and vomiting. No mention is made of what kind of vitamin C was taken, except that it was in the form of a large number of tablets, which would have had other ingredients that could lead to oxalate production. Also, the nausea and vomiting made it highly likely he was very dehydrated, a strong predisposing condition for the formation of calcium oxalate crystals. 3. Other cases have been reported with pre-existing kidney disease, a factor that will always substantially increase the risk of stone disease, regardless of what sources of oxalate production are present. Wang et al. Acute renal failure after vitamin C. Patient already had renal insufficiency secondary to malignant obstructive uropathy and was also ingesting large amounts of oxalate-rich herbs, including turkey rhubarb. McAllister et al. Acute renal failure after intravenous vitamin C. Patient already had advanced renal insufficiency. No evaluation of other possible risk factors was presented. All sources of oxalate, including vitamin C therapy, must be carefully monitored when administered to a patient with chronic renal failure and undergoing chronic hemodialysis. Indeed, a majority of patients on hemodialysis already have calcium oxalate deposits in their kidneys and hearts, and other hemodialysis patients have established calcium oxalate deposits in their bones. However, the answer is also not to completely avoid vitamin C supplementation, since increased oxidative stress is generated during hemodialysis and needs to be chronically addressed as well. Recommendations vary, but multiple authors have shown the need for some vitamin C supplementation in hemodialysis patients. In rat studies, Tamil Selvan and Selvam Have have shown that oxalate itself increases oxidative stress that initiates microprecipitates in the kidney. This mandates that good antioxidant therapy should be maintained to help prevent further crystal precipitation from taking place. These authors also showed that this oxalate challenge reliably decreased the kidney levels of vitamin C, vitamin E, and glutathione. This again supports the concept that a proper balance of antioxidant therapy, which includes vitamin C, must be found in order to maintain optimal health for chronic renal failure patients. One point needs to be clearly emphasized at this point. In reviewing the scientific literature, no report was found in which vitamin C was identified as the sole factor responsible for causing renal failure secondary to excess calcium oxalate crystal formation in a normal person. Dehydration and pre-existing kidney disease are probably the two most consistent conditions and risk factors that would facilitate a dramatic decline in kidney function after vitamin C therapy. Furthermore, it is clear in reviewing the literature that very few of the many risk factors for increased oxalate formation are addressed with any precision, especially once it is known that a patient with stone disease took any vitamin C. Would it be possible to cause calcium oxalate stone disease in an otherwise normal person with enough vitamin C? Possibly, but it would almost have to involve a situation in which substantial dehydration and or several other of the risk factors noted earlier were already present. Vitamin C, as with many other nutrients and medications, should always be accompanied by generous hydration. High solute intake with low urine volume will always increase concentrations of everything present, inviting crystal precipitation. I feel that vitamin C should be given in minimal doses, only if someone simply will not drink water. Even normal physiology can be pushed only so far. Specific vitamin C dosing recommendations, along with suggestions for dosing the patient at a slightly higher risk for stone formation, will be addressed in Chapter 6. Vitamin C, antioxidant and prooxidant. In discussing this topic, it is first very important to know the differences between an in vivo research study and an in vitro research study. In vivo means the research looked at the reaction and interaction of the entire body with the substances being studied, while in vitro means the research looked at how one thing interacted with something else outside of the body, as in the test tube. Furthermore, in vitro research systems can be very remote from the circumstances of the body, as in observing how two of the body's chemicals interact in a solute unrelated to the body. However, an in vitro study can be much closer to an in vivo study when, for example, living cells and tissues are researched outside of the body. Whenever trying to appreciate how much validity a given study may have to a clinical situation, one must always look at what type of study was done, how close that study reproduces the environment of the body if done outside of the body, and how many other researchers have successfully repeated similar research studies. Under varying conditions, vitamin C has been demonstrated to have either prooxidant or antioxidant properties. A prooxidant promotes oxidation and the increased presence of oxidative stress and free radicals, while an antioxidant does the opposite. That vitamin C can sometimes display prooxidant properties should not come as too great a surprise, since it is such an effective antiviral and general antimicrobial agent. Logically, there have to exist some circumstances that allow vitamin C to attack and destroy invading microorganisms or cancer cells, often through destructive pro-oxidative processes, while still having a protective antioxidant effect for the normal cells of the body. Carr and Fry reviewed 44 in vivo studies while addressing the question of whether vitamin C can act as a prooxidant under physiological conditions. They found that 38 of these studies showed a reduction in markers of oxidative DNA, lipid, and protein damage. A total of 14 demonstrated no change, and 6 showed laboratory evidence of increased oxidative stress after vitamin C supplementation. Carr and Fry concluded that any studies looking for a prooxidant effect from vitamin C should be evaluated carefully as to their choice of biomarkers, methodology, study system, and experimental design to rule out any oxidation artifacts. They further concluded that vitamin C does not act as a prooxidant under typical physiological conditions. Butner and Yurkevich demonstrated that vitamin C can serve as either a prooxidant or an antioxidant, depending upon its concentration in an experimental system. However, it is important to realize that vitamin C can only directly have an antioxidant function, meaning it can only lose electrons to another chemical in the process of becoming its oxidized form, dehydroascorbic acid. In the presence of metals like copper and iron that readily exchange electrons, the antioxidant loss of the electrons from vitamin C to these metals results in an increased ability of the metals to subsequently have a prooxidant activity in their immediate microenvironment. In their reduced form, these catalytic metals greatly facilitate the formation of free radicals and increased oxidative stress in the form of superoxide radicals, hydroxyl radicals, and hydrogen peroxide. Therefore, the net effect is that vitamin C, in the presence of the right concentration of iron and/or copper ions, can result in pro-oxidant activity, even though the direct and immediate effect exerted by the vitamin C was an antioxidant one. Typically, in such a catalytic metal environment, lower vitamin C concentrations favor pro-oxidant effects, while higher concentrations favor antioxidant effects. The researchers also observed that virtually all experimental systems where vitamin C facilitated pro-oxidant activity also had metal catalysts, usually as iron or copper ions. They termed the transition from pro-oxidant activity to antioxidant activity the crossover effect. They also noted that this crossover point was variable in the research published by many others. However, the consistent finding was that where catalytic metal concentrations were relatively lower, antioxidant properties predominated. Conversely, relatively higher catalytic metal concentrations could promote pro-oxidant effects. This proposition also fits well with the observed clinical fact that many people have taken extremely large doses of vitamin C without ever showing any pro-oxidant effect. Generally, it is only in daily dose ranges from the small recommended dietary allowance of 60 milligrams for the adult up to about 2,000 milligrams that vitamin C can ever exert a pro-oxidant effect. Furthermore, this would still require an unusual clinical situation in which the supplementing individual has high circulating levels or tissue levels of one or more catalytic metals. Practically speaking, if a low dose of vitamin C has someone feeling at all poorly, a larger dose will almost always be the solution for feeling better when there are no exceptionally large catalytic metal excesses present. The simple reason for this suggestion is that a large amount of excess vitamin C is the single best immediate therapy to either quench freshly produced free radicals or undo their immediate damage to the surrounding tissues. Even if localized concentrations of catalytic metals continue to produce free radicals, extra vitamin C will always immediately neutralize them or their acute harm before chronic damage is done. Furthermore, this is consistent with the results seen repeatedly with individuals taking megagram doses of vitamin C. Podmore et al. Concluded that 500 milligrams daily of vitamin C for 6 weeks increased the levels of a marker substance that indicated DNA damage resulting from increased free radicals. No analysis of the iron status in these volunteers was reported. Nevertheless, the result does raise some concern about chronically supplementing with a dose of vitamin C as low as 500 milligrams, which is probably roughly the amount that very many supplementers take. The many positive observed effects of much higher doses of vitamin C must be considered here, in spite of the theoretical concern that if a little is bad, more has to be worse. In fact, at least in the case of vitamin C, and perhaps antioxidants in general, the exact opposite appears to be true. A little might be bad, but more is always good. Hallowell also pointed out that vitamin C is not the only antioxidant that can be demonstrated to induce pro-oxidant activity. Rather, pro-oxidant activity is a characteristic of any compound that can receive or donate electrons in the typical oxidation-reduction chemical reaction. Many such agents, including glutathione, NADH, NADPH, and flavonoids, can be shown to promote pro-oxidant activities in addition to displaying their more commonly recognized antioxidant activities. Again, the presence of enough catalytic metals is typically required for the pro-oxidant properties to emerge. Since it appears that the presence of catalytic metals is the primary requirement for causing vitamin C and other antioxidants to sometimes demonstrate pro-oxidant activity, it is important to know what causes these metallic ions to be available inside the body and why they are unavailable most of the time. In a healthy state, ionic copper and iron remain in forms that keep them from promoting oxidative reactions. In normal human plasma, these metallic ions remain bound and sequestered in the circulating blood proteins. No freely circulating or protein-unbound iron and copper ions are normally present. Hemochromatosis is a disease characterized by a generalized overload of iron that eventually results in damage to tissues where iron is deposited. Hemochromatosis can be inherited, or it can occur secondary to a number of other predisposing factors or diseases. These secondary forms are much more common than the inherited form. Secondary hemochromatosis is commonly associated with certain types of anemia, and it is frequently seen in persons receiving too many blood transfusions or ingesting too much iron, often as supplementation. One of the initial laboratory abnormalities to appear in evolving hemochromatosis is an increased transferrin level. Transferrin is the serum protein, beta globulin, that binds and transports iron throughout the body. Iron bound to transferrin is not generally available for exerting a pro-oxidant effect with vitamin C and other antioxidants. In hemochromatosis and other iron overload disorders, a significant portion of the total plasma iron is not bound to transferrin, but circulates in the form of low molecular weight complexes. These researchers also suggested that this non-transferrin-bound iron was a likely important source of the iron that eventually deposits in the liver in iron overload disorders. Furthermore, as iron stores increase and the transferrin in the blood approaches 100% iron saturation, the deposition of iron throughout the body in the storage form known as hemosiderin increases. Then, as hemosiderin deposits continue to grow, localized oxidative tissue damage from excess iron becomes more manifest as well. Probably because of this, hemochromatosis patients have low serum and white blood cell levels of vitamin C. Several case reports have asserted that the administration of vitamin C to iron overloaded patients was likely associated with negative clinical consequences. McLaren et al. Reported that a 29-year-old man who ultimately died from congestive cardiomyopathy, poorly contracting enlarged heart, associated with hemochromatosis, had been taking 1,000 milligrams of supplemental vitamin C daily for his last year. However, significant clinical deterioration had taken place over the last 2 months of his life. Generally, the median survival time after the diagnosis of hemochromatosis is only 2 years, and heart failure is often the immediate cause of death. One could hypothesize that the vitamin C supplementation had actually benefited this man for 9 or 10 months, but that the disease finally prevailed. The case reported by Robotham and Roser was somewhat similar. A 47-year-old man had a declining clinical picture with increasing heart failure for the prior 3 months leading up to his clinical presentation. He had taken 500 milligrams of vitamin C daily for 3 years, and this dose was increased to 1,000 milligrams daily for another year. This patient did not die, but responded well to iron chelation therapy. Again, it is very unclear whether the vitamin C supplementation was the culprit causing the clinical decline. If vitamin C was responsible for worsening the clinical condition of either patient involved in these case reports, the relationship between vitamin C and iron becomes even more difficult to fully understand, especially in light of studies looking at the effects of vitamin C on iron-overloaded patients in vivo. Berger et al. Looked at the plasma vitamin C levels of 29 preterm infants and 5 adult controls. In these patients, the authors also looked at levels of a certain form of iron felt to be biologically active and capable of causing oxidative damage in vivo. After looking at the laboratory markers of oxidative stress and levels of oxidized vitamin C, they concluded that vitamin C acted as an antioxidant in iron-overloaded plasma in vivo. Furthermore, they asserted their data indicated that vitamin C, in the presence of excess iron in vivo, did not cause any oxidative damage to lipids or proteins. In healthy volunteers, Rehman et al. Showed that the increased oxidative stress seen after 6 weeks of supplementation with both vitamin C, either 60 milligrams or 260 milligrams daily, and iron, disappeared after 12 weeks of supplementation. This may indicate that longer supplementation with even small amounts of vitamin C may result in early pro-oxidant effects, eventually giving way to antioxidant effects as body stores of vitamin C gradually increase. This may also help to explain why a study by Shilotri and Bhatt, which lasted only 15 days, showed that a daily vitamin C supplement resulted in impaired white blood cell immune function rather than the anticipated improvement. Based on the work of Rehman et al., vitamin C supplementation studies should probably be extended to at least 12 weeks to better observe the long-term effects of chronic supplementation on what is being studied. Chen et al. Looked at vitamin C and iron overload in guinea pigs. They were able to demonstrate that vitamin C acted as an antioxidant to lipids in vivo, even in the presence of an iron overload. They also noted that iron loading by itself did not cause oxidative lipid damage, but was associated with a growth retardation and tissue damage that were not affected by the doses of vitamin C given. It was further noted that iron loading in animals with a low vitamin C status lowered vitamin E levels and increased plasma triglycerides. This indicates that the iron in this situation probably had a non-specific toxic effect. Such an effect would increase the triglycerides and deplete vitamin E, which was the available antioxidant. Also studying guinea pigs, Collis et al. Performed in vivo studies looking at the effects of vitamin C and iron supplementation. Vitamin C displayed no pro-oxidant activity in the face of simultaneous iron supplementation. In fact, it actually lessened the evidence of oxidative stress induced by the iron supplementation alone. In other words, vitamin C remained a powerful protective antioxidant in this in vivo experimental setting, even in the presence of extra iron. Vitamin C also plays a role in the absorption of iron from the digestive tract. In persons with low iron stores, vitamin C can significantly enhance the absorption of iron from plant sources. Gerster also noted that a prolonged intake of high-dose vitamin C has been shown not to change iron balance in iron-replete persons. However, Gerster further commented that a proper study has not yet been done to determine whether vitamin C further enhances iron absorption in people with hemochromatosis, an effect that would be highly undesirable. Cathcart reported treating over 20,000 patients with daily vitamin C doses ranging from 4,000 to 200,000 milligrams. Although he reported no significant vitamin C side effects in these patients, he also failed to mention whether any undesirable gradual accumulations of iron were taking place in any of these patients. Such a side effect would require specific blood testing, since it would not show up in the routine blood testing done on most people having general checkups. Even though this side effect would be unlikely, it cannot be completely ruled out as a possibility at this time in patients with or without hemochromatosis. Until one or more definitive studies can be conducted, blood testing of very high-dose vitamin C users should probably include at least an annual check on the levels of ferritin and iron to make sure no subclinical accumulations of iron are developing. Vitamin C and G6PD deficiency. Glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, G6PD, is an enzyme in the red blood cell, RBC, that is critical to the physical stability of the cell. The prime function of G6PD appears to be in protecting the red blood cell from oxidative damage. G6PD deficiency is a genetic disease inherited as an X-linked trait, predisposing the patient to episodes of mild to serious RBC rupture, known as hemolytic crises. Multiple oxidant compounds, such as primaquine, acetylphenylhydrazine, and sulfonamides, have been known to provoke hemolytic crises in G6PD deficient individuals. For unclear reasons, G6PD deficiency is probably a condition that warrants some concern when giving higher doses of vitamin C, especially intravenously. Rees et al. Reported on a 32-year-old man of Nigerian descent who initially did quite well in his ingestion of vitamin C and other nutrients as treatment for an HIV-positive status with generalized lymphadenopathy. Even though the patient received 40,000 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C three times weekly for about a month, along with 20,000 to 40,000 milligrams of oral vitamin C daily, he immediately sustained a hemolytic crisis with blackened urine the day after having an 80,000 milligram intravenous administration of vitamin C. This response did not appear to be readily predictable, since no problem with the vitamin C dosing had been encountered for the entire month leading up to the increased dose. Subsequent testing confirmed a G6PD deficiency along with sickle cell trait. Vigorous hydration facilitated his uneventful recovery. Campbell et al. Reported on a 68-year-old black man who eventually died from acute renal failure after a massive hemolytic crisis following the administration of 80,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously on two consecutive days. Testing later showed he had G6PD deficient red blood cells. In vitro research by Winterburn showed that a low concentration of vitamin C protected against the rupture of G6PD deficient red blood cells. However, a higher dose of vitamin C was found to actually promote rupture. Udomratan et al. Also demonstrated a reduced survival rate of G6PD deficient red blood cells in the presence of vitamin C in rats. Although the results of that research and clinical reports warrant some concern when giving vitamin C to anyone with a documented G6PD deficiency, the mechanisms involved in stimulating a hemolytic crisis are not clear. Furthermore, the vast quantities of vitamin C taken throughout the world today would suggest that reports of such hemolytic crises would be far more frequent if vitamin C reliably caused red blood cell rupture whenever a G6PD deficiency is present. The work of Marva et al. Suggested that the relationship between increased vitamin C and increased rupture of G6PD deficient red blood cells is related to an increased immediate availability of iron in these cells. The ability of iron to evoke a pro-oxidant effect by vitamin C was addressed in the previous section. Marva et al. Looked at malaria parasite-infected red blood cells. They found that vitamin C was highly toxic to advanced forms of the malaria parasite in infected red blood cells. As the malaria parasite grows in a red blood cell, hemoglobin is progressively digested. This digestive process releases the iron-containing heme core from hemoglobin within the red blood cell. This may make iron more available to any vitamin C or other antioxidant present, thereby facilitating the destruction of the parasite and red blood cell through the pro-oxidant effect discussed in the previous section. Consistent with this reasoning, the G6PD deficient red blood cell has been shown to allow the release of the iron-containing heme from the hemoglobin even more readily than the normal red blood cell. Since locally released iron can readily be provoked to induce pro-oxidant activity, This provides at least one good reason why these cells are more susceptible to oxidative stress and rupture. The study of Marva et al. Gives an excellent example of how vitamin C can have a very focal pro-oxidant effect in the destruction of an invading microbe while retaining its primary protective antioxidant effects over the remaining cells and tissues. Calabrese et al. Demonstrated that G6PD deficient red blood cells incubated with copper and vitamin C developed pre-hemolytic changes. However, the authors acknowledged that the copper levels used were 15 to 30 times greater than normally found in plasma. Nevertheless, such a study does suggest that when a large enough amount of a catalytic metal, such as copper, is accompanied by a low enough amount of vitamin C, the crossover effect discussed earlier can result in a positive net amount of pro-oxidant activity. Cathcart hypothesized that a high enough dose of vitamin C would tend to keep the glutathione in the G6PD deficient red blood cells at risk in the reduced state, able to better buffer the red blood cell against any potentially hemolytic oxidant stress. A low reduced glutathione level in a G6PD deficient red blood cell is a finding that indicates an increased risk of oxidant-induced rupture, because adequate levels of reduced glutathione are needed by the red blood cell to repair any oxidant-induced damage. A reasonable conclusion regarding G6PD deficiency is that definite evidence exists to show that at least rarely, vitamin C can promote a hemolytic crisis in individuals with this condition. It is unclear, however, exactly what circumstances will reliably predict when a hemolytic crisis will occur. Some evidence indicates that higher doses of vitamin C should have a protective effect against a hemolytic crisis in susceptible red blood cells. However, one case report clearly showed that a lower dose of vitamin C was tolerated well, while a higher dose seemed to be the hemolysis-inducing factor. Certainly, many large doses of intravenous vitamin C have already been given throughout the world, and there are still very few reports of problems with G6PD deficient patients in the literature. This is especially significant since G6PD deficiency causes some degree of anemia in over 100 million people, and it is considered the most common inborn error of metabolism. Nevertheless, at the very least, screening for G6PD deficient persons should be done in the patient populations considered to be at risk for this condition. The clinician would then have an early warning of any possible problems that could develop with vitamin C administration. Groups at primary risk include American blacks, black Africans, and the Mediterranean, Indian, and Southeast Asian populations. Vitamin C and cancer. Lee and Blair published a paper in Science that received widespread media coverage. It was a test tube study that concluded vitamin C facilitated the production of DNA-damaging agents known to produce mutations, which were associated with a variety of cancers. Blair, in a press interview, wanted to emphasize the point that the study results did not mean that vitamin C causes cancer. However, the implication remained. Also, the amount of vitamin C used in the experiment of Lee and Blair was considered to be roughly the equivalent of a human supplementing 200 milligrams daily. Such a low dose of vitamin C is much more likely to result in a pro-oxidant effect compared to much larger doses. Furthermore, similar findings had already been demonstrated by numerous researchers before the work of Lee and Blair. In addition to reaching a scientifically unsound conclusion, Lee and Blair asserted that vitamin C was ineffective for the prevention of cancer. A number of very current studies argue very strongly otherwise. In light of the vast amounts of existing research, advising patients against a significant daily supplementation of vitamin C borders on medical malpractice, and the omission of daily vitamin C certainly opens the door to multiple degenerative disease processes that need not otherwise develop. While test tube research has an invaluable place in scientific research, it simply cannot be relied upon in reaching definitive clinical conclusions. What takes place in a test tube is often quite different from what takes place in humans. The primary value of an in vitro study is to determine how two or more chemicals react in a well-defined, reproducible, and tightly controlled environment. As already discussed in this chapter, vitamin C can easily and consistently be observed to induce pro-oxidant activity in the right microenvironment. Vitamin C has already been proven as a very safe form of supplementation and therapy for chronic cancer patients. As was already noted at the start of this chapter, Kashyari et al. Reported that multiple cancer patients were given up to 50,000 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C daily for as long as 8 weeks without any noteworthy negative effects. Reardon et al. Gave 100,000 milligram intravenous doses of vitamin C over 5-hour periods daily for about a week to a terminal cancer patient with no negative effect noted. The only effects noted were a significant improvement in strength and general well-being. Reardon et al. Reported on another cancer patient who responded well to receiving multiple 30,000 milligram intravenous doses of vitamin C over an extended period of time. These authors commented that during and after the treatments, the patient showed no toxic or unusual side effects from the vitamin C infusions. Reardon et al. Also reported on 6 cancer patients receiving multiple intravenous infusions of vitamin C over 8-hour periods. The amounts infused ranged from 57,500 milligrams to 115,000 milligrams with no reported negative effects. Although intravenous vitamin C therapy is very well tolerated by most patients, including severely ill cancer patients, a few negative acute reactions to this form of therapy have been reported. Campbell and Jack reported negative side effects in 3 cancer patients, 2 with Hodgkin's disease and 1 with bronchial cancer. All 3 patients had evidence of a significant cancer mass in their bodies. One patient developed an acute fever and pain in the cancer mass in his chest after receiving 30,000 milligrams of oral and intravenous vitamin C over a period of 36 hours. Another patient had symptoms of acute mediastinal compression following a total dose of 100,000 milligrams of vitamin C. It would appear that some patients who have received no prior regular vitamin C supplementation can be very susceptible to the effects of vitamin C on their tumor mass. Especially when the tumor mass is greater, the vitamin C effect can cause acute cell death in the tumor, which can release toxic byproducts into the blood and/or cause an acute swelling of the tumor mass. Although these possibilities are rare, initial vitamin C supplementation should be no more than 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams daily by mouth for at least the first week or two. Initial intravenous vitamin C infusions should contain only 5,000 to 10,000 milligrams before proceeding to higher doses. Hydration should always be vigorous, and a high volume of urinary output should be consistently maintained. Another possible concern to some cancer patients has been reported by Basu and Calabrese. In cancer patients who choose to take Laetril as one of their chemotherapy agents, a possible side effect from the simultaneous dosing of vitamin C has been suggested. Laetril contains cyanide, which is normally detoxified by cysteine, a sulfur-containing amino acid. Vitamin C, in doses of 3,000 milligrams daily, has been observed to reduce both cysteine and thiocyanate levels in the urine. This has been interpreted to mean that vitamin C lessens the cysteine available for cyanide detoxification, and the lower thiocyanate level means that less cyanide has been effectively metabolized. Basu later showed that urinary thiocyanate levels in guinea pigs were significantly elevated after Laetril administration, even though these elevations were less marked when vitamin C was also given. No mention of any clinical evidence of cyanide toxicity was made, however, in the guinea pigs given both vitamin C and Laetril. Even if the data actually indicates a degree of acutely increased cyanide toxicity in the tissues of a vitamin C supplementer taking Laetril, lessening or eliminating vitamin C intake is not necessarily the solution. Generally, larger amounts of vitamin C will successfully address many different toxicities, even when the benefits of lower doses of vitamin C are not clear. Cyanides are potent poisons that readily induce increased oxidative stress and the formation of free radicals in the tissues. Kantasamy et al. Demonstrated this effect in rat cell cultures exposed to cyanide. These authors also showed that vitamin C lessened the cyanide-induced oxidative stress and blocked the cyanide-induced cell death in these cultures. It is a good possibility that any potential side effect of increased cyanide levels produced by Laetril and lower levels of vitamin C would be completely negated by giving more vitamin C. Vitamin C and intentional immune system suppression. There are certain medical conditions that are treated with immunosuppressive drugs. Some of these medical conditions, such as systemic lupus erythematosus or multiple sclerosis, are considered to be at least partially due to an overactive immune system. Because of this reasoning, such diseases are traditionally felt to be best treated by a combination of prescription medicines that will suppress aspects of the immune system. In fact, many of these diseases may be largely due to unneutralized toxins. Clinically, both lupus and multiple sclerosis respond well to high-dose vitamin C therapy. If a strengthened immune system truly made these diseases worse, vitamin C therapy would not be a reasonable treatment. However, if the presence of toxins is the cause of such diseases, then vitamin C, with its antitoxic properties, is arguably one of the best treatment choices for such diseases. There are other medical conditions in which immunosuppressive medical therapy is absolutely essential. Such conditions are best characterized by organ transplantations. When a patient receives a donor heart or kidney, the process of rejection mediated by the immune system must be continuously suppressed for the life of the patient, or the organ will eventually be rejected. If no new organ is available for repeat transplantation, dire or even fatal consequences will likely result. Although it is not clear whether it is best to supplement such patients with multigram doses of vitamin C for an indefinite period of time, there is no doubt that some vitamin C and chronic antioxidant therapy is of great benefit to these patients. However, it is unclear if a certain dosage level of vitamin C might increase the chances of organ rejection by strengthening the suppressed immune system too effectively, although no definite evidence was found indicating that vitamin C in any dosage would be a problem for the transplant patient, it remains a theoretical possibility. At least one study that supports giving vitamin C in very large doses to transplant patients came from Slakey et al. These researchers found that vitamin C increased the survival times of transplanted rat hearts. The recipient rats also received cyclosporin for immunosuppression, but vitamin C was not found to enhance the immunosuppressive effect of cyclosporin as measured by mixed lymphocyte response testing. Nevertheless, the dose of vitamin C that was successful in prolonging transplanted heart survival was approximately equivalent to 100,000 milligrams daily for a 200-pound person. This study certainly suggests that any of the theoretical negative effects of vitamin C on the rejection process of transplanted organs are more than outweighed by its many other positive effects, since the heart transplants in rats with high-dose vitamin C clearly outlasted the heart transplants without the vitamin C. Some clinicians may consider it better to omit vitamin C supplementation in transplant patients in order to avoid any chances of stimulating the suppressed immune systems and accelerating the rejection process. However, Williams et al. Suggested that increased oxidative stress may play a major role in the rejection process for lung transplant patients. Furthermore, these authors found that this increased oxidative stress was accompanied by a compromised antioxidant status in patients. Although a study such as this confirms the need for some antioxidant supplementation, it still does not suggest the most appropriate dose. Further evidence that some vitamin C should be given to transplant patients comes from the work of Fang et al. In a double-blind prospective study, these researchers looked at the progression of arteriosclerosis in the blood vessels of transplanted hearts. The treated group received 500 milligrams of vitamin C and 400 international units of vitamin E, each twice daily for 1 year. The researchers concluded that this regimen of vitamins C and E retards the early progression of transplant-associated coronary arteriosclerosis. Thorner et al. Studied the white blood cells in patients who received kidney transplants. They found that the chronic steroid therapy given to these patients caused a defect in the delivery response of these immune cells to sites of bacterial invasion, which leads to increased susceptibility to infection. These researchers found that 4,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily for several weeks significantly improved this delivery function in the white blood cells, with no change noted in graft function. The proper doses of vitamin C and other antioxidants in transplant patients will be variable, just as they are with patients who have not undergone a transplant procedure. Different people, depending upon their underlying diseases and daily toxin exposures, will require different doses of vitamin C to maintain a given blood level. Whether there is a daily dose of vitamin C in a transplant patient that should never be exceeded has not been determined. Vitamin C and the rebound effect. Some authors have expressed concern that taking large doses of vitamin C can put the supplementing person at risk for developing a suddenly diminished level of vitamin C when abruptly discontinuing supplementation. To a limited degree, this assertion is valid. Sao and Salimi looked at the urinary excretion pattern of vitamin C in two volunteers who took 10,000 milligrams daily. One volunteer took this dose for 2 weeks before discontinuation, and the other took it for 6 weeks. Discontinuing the vitamin C after 2 weeks of supplementation resulted in a drop of urinary vitamin C excretion below basal levels on the 8th day after discontinuation, and the levels remained low for 2 days before coming back up. The subject who supplemented for 6 weeks dropped less dramatically, but remained on the lower side of normal for a longer period of 12 days. Sao and Salimi hypothesized that vitamin C supplementation induces the increased activity of enzymes that metabolically break it down. When supplementation is abruptly discontinued, the increased enzyme activity is felt to persist temporarily while continuing to break down vitamin C at an accelerated rate. In turn, the levels of vitamin C temporarily drop below levels considered normal. Pauling had earlier hypothesized this enzyme activity induction by vitamin C. Practically speaking, the sudden discontinuation of vitamin C will rarely have clinically significant consequences. However, if one discontinues a long-term supplementation while members of the family are sick with colds or flu, the opportunity for contracting such an infection would probably be somewhat increased. Perhaps the scenario of greatest concern involves the sudden discontinuation of long-term supplementation after being acutely hospitalized for trauma or medical illness. At such times, the need for vitamin C will be greatly increased while body levels are dropping. Unless vitamin C supplementation can be continued in the hospital at perhaps even larger doses, an increased rate of complications during the hospitalization with increased morbidity and mortality is quite possible. Summary. Many researchers in numerous different studies have clearly established that vitamin C is one of the safest supplements or nutrient substances that can be taken. Multigram doses of vitamin C taken daily over a period of years are virtually devoid of any side effects. Furthermore, even very high oral 200,000 milligram and intravenous 300,000 milligram doses of vitamin C over a 24-hour period have also been shown to be safe.